नमः ओम विष्णु पदाय कृष्ण प्रस्ताय भूतले श्रीमती भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी की नंदे नमस्ते सरस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारणे निर्विशेषा शून्यवारी प्रचार प्रचारणे ओम ज्ञान तिमरम दस्य जनांजना सलाकाय सत्तुर निरचन जन सजमाय श्री गिरवे नमः So I'm offering my obeisances to my spiritual master, Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Prabhupada. So kindly opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge while I was standing in the midst of Dwarka's dignity. So in a few days we're actually going to begin the Srila Prabhupada centennial year. So I thought to talk something about Srila Prabhupada and also just about the principle of the spiritual master and how Srila Prabhupada was able to do what he did, and how also those of us who try to follow in his footsteps can also be effective. Because Srila Prabhupada had a certain potency. And I thought one of the best ways to illustrate this, recently in Detroit in November, I was one of the persons who organized a conference of scholars. There was about six of us were initiated devotees, and there was another eight or so who were scholars but who weren't devotees. But we got together to talk about Srila Prabhupada and assess his achievement. And this was at the So we did this at the Detroit Temple, and this was funded by the grace of the North American Bhaktivedanta Book Trust, because it costs money to fly everybody there and to put them up for a few nights and so on. And the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust is going to publish in June a book of articles based on that conference of scholars and talking about the achievements and significance of Srila Prabhupada. So because I was the main organizer of this conference, and I also gave a paper, one of the people that gave a paper, I had occasion to think a lot about Srila Prabhupada over the course of the year. So one of the things I wanted to do was give the scholars like a little packet of stuff, you know, you get a nice little folder and everything. And, you know, I had a menu and a schedule. The menu was the secret ingredient. See, with scholars, you can't tell them now, only say nice things about Prabhupada. Because they'll just turn around right away and say something that's not nice. But I thought that if we really treated them with, true Vedic hospitality and gave them great prasadam, that would affect their hearts, so they could see into get some insight into Srila Prabhupada. And it worked very well. It was quite successful. One professor, Klaus Klostermeyer, wrote me afterwards. He said that he can't remember ever being so happy at a conference. Everyone was quite happy. And there was really something quite special. We had a U-shaped table. We're in the Great Hall in the Detroit Temple. And at one point, one of my godbrothers, Santosh Das, who has become, has gotten a degree in Indian devotional music, a doctorate degree, and teaches it in St. Louis, now in the university there, Loyola. He gave a talk about the Srila Prabhupada's contribution to music. And he had gotten together part of his lecture had little sound clips of Prabhupada chanting, and he talked about the various ragas Prabhupada used and the instruments and so on like that. And it was an interesting lecture in many ways. One of the things that happened is during the course of his lecture we all stopped and he played Prabhupada chanting. And I was, it had such an enormous effect, all of us sitting there, and I don't know what it was actually, because we had been, hearing about different ragas and things like that. But for some reason, the potency of Prabhupada chanting came through loud and clear. I was amazed, and I thought, well, maybe it's just me. You know, I just thought the whole mood of the place just, you know, got notched up quite a few degrees just because we all just heard Prabhupada chanting. But then Brahmananda, who was there, he said to me, wasn't that amazing, the Prabhupada chanting? He says, like I never heard it before. So it had that effect. And one of the interesting things that he did, and this will tie in a little bit with some of the things I have to say later, Santosh did, was he played the happening record, the original recording of Prabhupada chanting that was recorded in December of 66 here in New York on the happening label, and went out around the world. And then he described the various result, you know, effects of that kirtan. Of course, one thing that happened is there was a group of people had decided that it would be a great idea to do a musical about the hippie movement. This is the famous Hair musical, and so Santosh actually called up the songwriters and the writer for that play and asked them, you know, because they decided that in order to be authentic they would have to have Hare Krishnas in the big Bean scene in Central Park. This is a famous scene in the Hair. Because in the Bean, all the actors come off the stage and go out into the audience, and they're all chanting. Everyone's doing this, the chanting of Hare Krishna. And they use a tune that's a slight variant of the one that Prabhupada used. And so Santosh talked to them, and they said, yeah, they used to follow the kirtan parties around Greenwich Village and Tompkins Square Park. But they... just to get the authentic sound. They talked to him about that, and I was, while Santosh was talking, he handed me the sheet music for Hair, and I saw what had happened, because then he described in the Bean in Central Park, you know, that Hare Krishna, they do this, they flatten it a little bit, Hare Krishna, you know, that's the first verse. The second verse, same tune, is Marijuana, Marijuana. And that was the lyric. So you want to know where a lot of rumors started about the Hare Krishna movement? It was from that musical Hair. That was the second verse. Everybody chanting marijuana to the same tune. Well, then what happened? The fate, of course, that musical became quite a long running musical Hair, and then it became a film. And you can rent it at a video store today, and there's still devotees in the Central Park Bean. were you? So it got around. In fact, it got to India, and there was a famous Indian movie director named Devanand, the producer and director, who decided that he wanted to make a movie with the Hare Krishna devotees in it. I don't know how many people are you familiar with this story, but so what Devanand did was, I'm just trying to tell you some of the things that happened with Prabhupada's chanting and the various twists and turns it took. What Devanand did was he got together a story about an Indian girl, I guess, in Montreal or someplace, or Toronto, who becomes attracted to a Western hippie movement, and she joins the Hare Krishnas. And, you know, the whole drama is about how she comes back to her family and everything like that. So they wanted to, they had a scene in which, the Hare Krishna devotees are chanting and blowing reefer, smoking marijuana. And they made this look really authentic. What Devanand did was become a life member of ISKCON in Bombay, and invite all the devotees to his house, where they chanted and everything. And secretly, he filmed it. And then spliced this in later with his actors and everything like that. So then there was a song that went to this film, which became the number one, this became a big hit, this movie. and the song, which was, I think, inspired to some extent by the hair thing. The song was called Dambara Dum, Hare Krishna Hare Ram. Dambara Dum means something like puff after puff, or as we would say, with every toke I take, Hare Krishna Hare Ram. And this became a huge hit in India. Well, of course, the devotees were furious. I remember I went just after that movie came out. It was my first or second trip to India, and I was going in Delhi and Janpat, going down the street, and all these little kids were running after me, going Dum Bada Dum Hare Krishna Hare Rama. What is this about? You know, Dum Bada Dum. What is that? And so the whole, all of India was into this film and this song and everything. And of course the devotees were furious, they were upset with Devanand. But Prabhupada said, they will forget the Dambara Dum and they will remember the Hare Krishna Hare Ram, which has turned out to be correct. And Devanand actually, later he apologized realized he made a serious offense. and carrying this off. Meanwhile, on the other side, the happening record made its way to England by various underground sources. In fact, that was the first time I ever heard the chanting of Hare Krishna. It must have been in the winter of 67. A friend of mine was getting married. And this was in Powhatan Village in Philadelphia, which is sort of like Greenwich Village, and at that time it was a hippie neighborhood. And you know, there was a minister with some draft dodger who had gotten himself ordained somewhere at the United Churches of Christ, and there was the altar was his big table in the living room. The bride was very largely pregnant. This is one of my college friends who was getting married. There was a black cat walking back and forth across the altar as everybody read from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the I Ching, the Bhagavad Gita, and so on. It was one of those scenes. I said this was 1960. I think it was 67, wasn't it? 67. And then he said, "Now we got to hear something," my friend said. And we all sat down around sat down on the floor, and there was a lot of Dumbar Dum going on. And the guy queued up this big reel-to-reel tape recorder. This is before cassettes were invented. Or they may have been invented, but they weren't available. So he queued up this big reel-to-reel, you know, like a big tape. We got to listen. And we all were silent, and it was Prabhupada chanting Hare Krishna, you know. And we chanted, you know, when our turn came, we chanted, and it went on for a long time. I think, you know, it was recorded several times over that chant. So we chanted and chanted and chanted and chanted in the haze and everything like that. And I remember I heard that sound. It was like somebody calling from a long way away, you know, a long distance, calling and calling and calling and calling. Anyway, this is my friend. He had another friend of his, Tejas, who had become a devotee and had sent him down the tape recorder. That's the tape, and that's how. So that record, you know, it went around. I mean, it was a tape even before cassettes. People were passing around big reels. Tapes. Somehow or other, it made its way to England. The happening record, and George Harrison heard it, liked it. So later, when devotees came over there, very quickly, and the Krishna consciousness spread. I wanted to show, anyway, first, get back to this, that some of the fate of that thing. One of the things I made up for this Prabhupada conference, I realized that there was nowhere available in ISKCON a chronology of Prabhupada's life, like the significant events. One of the Prabhupada Lilamrita volumes has a chronology in it, but for the whole. So I got together with uh, Lila Vrindavan, Burijan's daughter, and asked if she could do this, and she made up this chronology. I made some copies, so if you guys want to pass them around, you can see. The significance events in the life of Srila Prabhupada. I put this in the folder for all these different scholars. Just that we're going to discuss Prabhupada, I thought we should get so there it's five pages, and like there's the main events in Prabhupada's life. This is all taken from the Prabhupada Lilamrita by Satrup Goswami. And I just wanted to, from this I was looking at it, and we won't go through the whole thing now, but if you look on the second page, on 13th of August 1965, Prabhupada set sail from Calcutta for the United States. And he arrives in Boston on the 17th of September. There were jet airplanes in those days, but he couldn't afford it. So he was traveling on a little cabin in a freighter donated by Sumati Maharaji of the Scindia steamship lines. Prabhupada observed his 70th birthday at sea. He also had a heart attack while he was coming. I mean, here's a person who's 70 years old. The whole country is worried about, you know, old age medical care and pension plans and everything like that. And this was Prabhupada's pension plan. He got on a ship and sailed to the United States. And he had no support whatsoever. There were currency restrictions, so all he could take out was was 40 rupees, which in those days was worth $7. And he did have, sponsorship from a friend of his son's in Butler, Pennsylvania. So Prabhupada was, well past retirement age and also ill. He had a heart attack. And so when he arrives in America, he gets on a bus and he goes to Butler, Pennsylvania, because that's the only, of all places, you know, it's halfway between Pittsburgh and Erie. It's really nowheresville, Butler. But that's where he went. And then he stayed there a while and came back. He stopped off at the University of Pennsylvania, where at that time I was a student, and on campus. I'd just gotten married the previous month. and I may have seen it, Prabhupada. I'm not sure. But anyway, he went to New York, and then already things are by July of 66, after a very hard winter in New York, where he says he saw snow for the first time. He said he thought somebody was on the roof throwing lime off. That was his first impression. You can imagine New York in the wintertime, and he must have been cold. So here in July of 66, in this place where we are right now, he started the first ISKCON temple in New York. So that's 1 year from the time he attained his visa to the time he started a temple. I mean, that's pretty far out, 1 year. What happens to our lives in 1 year? That's quite an accomplishment to get, to get a visa and get all the way from India. And remember, this was an adventure that nobody had really undertaken, except Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Prabhupada's spiritual master, had sent two sannyasis to London in the 1930s, Ban Maharaj and Tirtha Maharaj. They were there for about 4 years. They spent a fortune. They didn't collect any money. But Bhaktisiddhanta had gotten a donation from some Maharaj or something, I forgot who, big donation, and sent it to them to build a temple in London, actually, and the money vanished.
In the middle of the Depression?
Yeah, in the middle of the Depression. It was a fortune. That's true, it was the middle of the Depression, and it was worth a lot of money, and it disappeared. And they didn't have anything to show for it. Well, the only thing to show for it is when one of them, Bhad Maharaj, came back, he published a booklet showing his triumphant preaching tour. I've seen a copy of that booklet. It has the pictures of him meeting with Himmler and Goebbels. People like that. So nothing came of it. Four sannyasis with a huge deal of money. I mean, Bhaktisiddhanta was ready to back this up to the effort to the nth degree, and there was no success. That was the previous attempt to spread Krishna consciousness. So here Prabhupada comes, now he's by himself, he's 70 years old, he has no financial backing of $7, no logistical support from India or anywhere else. And one interesting feature of Prabhupada is sometimes when you look through Prabhupada, you what he was hoping for. And what he was hoping for was that the leading people, the intellectual elite of America or of the world, would take up Srimad Bhagavatam. Now the reason he thought so was that because it is, in Prabhupada's view, in this I agree with him, the finest product of human civilization. It's on the highest possible cultural level. Prabhupada, in one place, divided human culture up. He says there's the culture of the body, the culture of the mind, the culture of the intelligence, and the culture of the soul proper. The culture of the body is manifest in institutions like restaurants, health spas, bars, those places that people go, Disney World, you know, people go for just the enjoyment of the senses, that's the culture of the body. Then on a somewhat higher level, there's the culture of the mind. And this is embedded in universities and colleges, think tanks, and I guess the editorial offices of a few magazines here and there. And this is the culture of the mind. So people put forward various ideas for their intellectual amusement, play with them, think about them, entertain themselves with them, get tired of them, put them away, and take up a new toy. The mental platform, accepting and rejecting. When I read this the first time, this really struck home, because anyone who has studied something like the history of Western philosophy can see that that there's a kind of one thing goes to the next thing in Western philosophy. One idea is replaced by the next idea. Empiricism is replaced by idealism and so on. Whatever it may be, rationalism, all these different things go down. But it's not really that any idea is disproved. It's just that people get tired of it and go on to something else. This is the culture of the mind. So people are putting forth varied theories and ideas. They're fashionable. It really has no more significance than the changes in fashions. Go down on the Paris shows or anything. It's just arbitrary. Anyway, that's the culture of the mind. Then he said the culture of the intelligence is found in the Bhagavad Gita, actually. Buddhi, Krishna consciousness, devotional service is often called Buddhi Yoga. Intelligence is a higher faculty of discrimination. There's no equivalent for it that I know of in the West. Something of what we mean by willpower is there in discrimination. Something of what actually we mean by faith is there in Buddhi. Discrimination, discernment, all these things.
Conscience.
Conscience, yes, something of what we mean by conscience. That's also part of it. But there's no singular thing. I can't get into it now, but anyway, when the buddhi, or the higher faculty of intelligence, does its job and works its way all the way to the end, you surrender to Krishna. And that's what buddhi does. It is the way that the super soul actually gives us direction and guidance, ultimately. That's buddhi. So he says Bhagavad Gita is a culture of intelligence. And then beyond that is Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the culture of the soul proper. It is the ripened fruit of the Vedic tree of knowledge. So who's going to be able to appreciate this? Well, only the highly cultivated, most refined sorts of people, naturally. So when Prabhupada came here to America, he encountered at the University of Pennsylvania a very highly cultured person, Dr. Norman Brown, who didn't like Prabhupada very much. It was not a very fruitful encounter. He was one of the leading Indologists of America, and he was not very sympathetic with Srila Prabhupada. Then somehow or other the elite of the United States was simply not interested in this Swami with his robes on and his books he had printed in India with the bad binding and the typos and the cheap buttery sort of paper that almost dissolved when you touched it. It so happened that the first people that gathered around Srila Prabhupada just happened to be those people that later would be called the counterculture or hippies. Those people, those of us who were there, I know Tim Leary said if you can remember the 60s, you weren't there. But there are a few lucid patches. I do remember that the word hippie was an outsider word. The people that people called hippies called themselves either heads or freaks. So the people that gathered around Prabhupada were, for the most part, heads and freaks. And the most wonderful thing about Prabhupada is apparently he didn't blink an eye. Prabhupada had the tolerance this is who Krishna sending, and he wasn't going to turn them away. Later on, sometimes some of Prabhupada's godbrothers who didn't go to America, who went and didn't succeed, I claimed that the reason they didn't is they wanted higher class people, really. They weren't interested in such people as drug-addicted hippies. Anyway, Prabhupada didn't... he was cool, I guess. He was very cool. This is his Krishna son, and he accepted us. That's what he did. That's actually an amazing fact. Because the whole rest of the country is in the business of rejecting us. The freaks and the heads, you know. Those of you who weren't there just cannot imagine what it was like. The sort of intergenerational warfare that was going on. Of course, there were some students got at Kent State by the Ohio National Guard, and we really thought it was revolution. It was a very tense time. Everybody had cut themselves, I mean, this whole generation, so many of us had just cut ourselves loose from everything that our parents had to offer us. Which Prabhupada noted. And in America, you know, it was my parents, my age, who had, you know, grown up during the Depression, fought in World War II, come back and, you know, built Levittown and similar places, and then handed us everything after all the depression in World War II, handed us everything, and we went, yeah. So they were a little ticked off. But after all they had done and sacrificed, we wanted something else. anyway, so that's the kinds of people that gathered around Srila Prabhupada. He was cool. He didn't. He just took us right on. And one thing you have to understand, and to understand some of the things that happened in our movement after this time, was that this was not the most promising material. And people were, first of all, very young, and therefore not much experience. The only, the MBAs from Harvard were not at that time joining the movement in great droves. I was just reading one of Satyarup Maharaj's memoirs of the early days when he first came here to see Prabhupada. And the first time he went up to see Prabhupada in his room, he came in, he was working in a social welfare agency, as a social worker, and he came in to see Prabhupada to get some books. So he went upstairs back here to Prabhupada's room, and he was on his lunch break, and he had a coat and tie on. And Satyarup Maharaj says he came in probably sitting there, and there was a bunch of, Satyarup Maharaj called them boys, I mean young men, sitting around. Prabhupada was talking to them, and Satyarup Maharaj said that he would like to buy a set of Bhagavatam. And nobody moved. Nobody did anything except Prabhupada. And then he just sat there while Prabhupada got up and got the book. brought him to Satyarup Maharaj, then Steve Guarino. And then he pulled out $18, which he felt was a lot for three books, but anyway, had a $20 bill. And didn't know who to give it to. Nobody moved to take his money, so he gave it to Prabhupada. and Prabhupada, then somebody said, "Oh, we don't have any change." So he said, "Okay, that's okay. You can keep the $2." So then he got up to leave, and then Prabhupada said, "Sit down," like that, in that tone. And Satyarup sat down, but then he said to Prabhupada, then he felt bad because obviously Prabhupada wanted him to sit there so he could talk to him. But he was worried because he was on his lunch break, and he said to Prabhupada, "I'm sorry, I can't stay. I have to get back to work. I'm on my lunch break." And then Prabhupada broke out in this big smile. I mean, he was just so happy that somebody was responsible. And had a job and was going to be on time from his lunch break. And obviously was thinking, here's a person I can really use. Because, I mean, Satyarup Maharaj was, you know, a little square by the standards of the time. Anyway, the MBA, you know, it was rare most people simply had no experience. I know when I moved into the temple, I was an older person. I was 26. I very quickly, various circumstances, before I knew anything, I became the temple president simply because I was older than anybody else, and I'd actually held down a job at different points in the world, you know, and paid bills and different things like that in my life, and all of a sudden it made me a responsible person. Everybody was just so young, and Of course, it was, I didn't. I mean, I moved in, my wife and I moved in the temple in January. We initially aided in July, and sometime in September, October, I was the temple president. I didn't know anything, you know, which explains why, what things happened. Anyway, these are the people that came to the movement. And what happened is it started to grow very, very quickly. By September of 66, Prabhupada, I'm just following right along here, Prabhupada initiated people. In July, ISKCON was incorporated. I remember some devotees I knew from that time. Prabhupada said, now we will incorporate, and they said, he said, International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And they were devotees, all they could do to keep, they were cracking up inside anyway, because I mean, here they were, you know, there was this Swami and this little group of freaks and heads down south of Greenwich Village, and he's saying, International Society? You know, he had to be, it's such an idealist, you know. And one of these devotees, Nana Baram, he said to me, we just thought it was always going to go on like this, just, you know, the Swami and a few of us. And of course, some of them got very upset when the movement got larger and larger and larger. They really didn't like it at all. So people began to, it was a little group, and people began to come. It was very intimate. But you can see here that in January of 67, Prabhupada left 26 Second Avenue, and the testimony is that the devotees were shocked out of their minds that he could actually think of leaving and going somewhere else. I heard some of the stories in detail that I can't repeat here, but I think it was Mukunda Goswami, actually, who met Prabhupada here in New York, had all his friends, this little group of people from Reed College, another group of freaks and heads, by the way, who were in the assemblage of Ken Kesey, actually. Malati said that when she and her husband joined the movement, Ken Kesey took their dog. So there was a whole other, group. And of course, the second temple was at Haight-Ashbury, and Prabhupada's appearance in San Francisco this was arranged by Shama Sundar, who had a sort of a bootlegger's connection with the big rock groups. So there was in the Avalon Ballroom, there was the Montserrat dance where Prabhupada appeared with the Grateful Dead, Moby Grape, Big Brother and the Holding Company, and so on. So that was there was not for nothing that you know that that the first academic work on ISKCON was called Hare Krishna Mechaniculture. Many people did think we were just part of the hippie phenomena, and weren't really quite. What happened to the devotees who joined ISKCON is they were really double dropouts. You know, you just have to understand the distance you had to travel to become a devotee. First, you had to drop out from normal American society and join the counterculture. And then you had to drop out from the counterculture into Krishna consciousness, where you got spun around again. I mean, you went right around 360 degrees and found yourself, you know, getting up early in the morning, taking bath three times a day. Your hair's really short, except for this weird long piece. But, you know, all of a sudden you're straighter than the straight again. You know, you're like the kind of people, you behave like the kind of people who, you know, were Jesuit seminarians who dropped out and joined the FBI. You know, that kind of law and order sort of person. And yet, you know, you were farther to the right than anybody else and farther to the left than anybody else. It was hard to understand. But that's what happened. People became kind of double dropouts. Not everyone perceived, you know, it was an amazing thing that Prabhupada could have found a niche within the counterculture and yet preach against it so strongly and unrelentingly all the time, if you sometimes go through the folio database and look up Prabhupada's take on hippies and so on, it's not nice at all. He was not a fan at all of the cluster of words, lazy, unemployed, drug addicted, sleeping on the streets, you know, on and on and on and on and on, like that kind of thing. Morose. One time he said, I have taken hippies and turned them into happies. Meaning from the mode of ignorance to the mode of goodness. Anyway, so that was the second one in Haight-Ashbury. So you can see that just in this, you know, from January to April, the Montserrat dance was there. Jagannath was destroyed. The first deity worship was there. Look how fast Prabhupada is moving. You know, I mean, this is really lightning speed. Deity worship? I mean, when did the first people get initiated? You know? But you know, somebody had found the deity. Malati, I guess, had found the deities in an import store, Jagannath deities, and took them to Prabhupada, and was surprised when he offered obeisances, and Shamsundar carved big ones. And people didn't know what they were doing. She just told me that Shamsundar was carving the deities. Prabhupada came in, there was a pack of cigarette palm oil sitting on top of Jagannath. He hadn't quite realized what all those vows meant. But Prabhupada was just, he was, the expression he used, done for working. He was doing for working, you know, as he was being practical. So he comes back to New York, so that things are moving very, very fast. And then you can actually see why. In June of 67, he suffers a stroke. Right? There was a heart attack, you know, and now there's a stroke. So with that heart attack, you know, that was the first, you know, stroke, sign of mortality. Boom. You know, it's knocking at the door. Here's death. Boom. He's 70 years old, and Prabhupada is thinking, how much time do I have? Yeah. And he never knew how much time that he would have. At least that's the way he explains it. He just always worked on the assumption that we have to do things very, very, very quickly. Whether I go or stay, that's Krishna's business, but I'm going to work very quickly. So that was always that. He was already 70 years old, and he used to say, I may leave at any minute. I may go at any time. I'm an old man. But there was a stroke, and he was put into a Beth Israel hospital. He stayed there a very short time in the hospital. He didn't like it at all. The doctors thought his chanting all the time was causing him health problems. They're poking him with needles. Prabhupada came back out and instructed devotees that he should be massaged continuously, meaning shifts, without non-stop, on the paralyzed side. And he recuperated in this way. He went briefly to the New Jersey shore to try to recuperate. And then went to San Francisco. Then there was the Rath Yatra, the first Rath Yatra in July, on the flatbed truck. And then he still was having trouble getting together, and he went off in July back to India to recover his health. And many devotees who were there at that time thought, most of them thought, we're never going to see him again. He's going back to Vrindavan to die, to leave his body. That's what they thought. But in the event, he came back 4.5 months later. Proceeds to go to Los Angeles, opens a temple there, opens the Boston temple. This is in 68, January, May, I mean, so fast, Montreal temple. And then he did this interesting thing. That's where he sent three married couples to preach in London. And you have to understand what London means, somebody from India, you know. It's like Rome, the capital of the empire. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had sent two sannyasis there in the 30s and didn't do anything. Prabhupada sent three married couples. And then the news articles came back, Hare Krishna takes London by storm. because what had happened was that somehow or other they met up with George Harrison. He had heard the Happening record. He wanted to record the Hare Krishna mantra on the Apple label. That was done, and in Europe and London, the Hare Krishna mantra quickly became very at the top of the charts for quite some time. And just like that, from it's very, very, very quickly. And so things go on like that. That's as far as I'll follow this on now. But you can see it was actually, if you look and you see how much time Prabhupada had, he had 12 years. And more time has passed since Prabhupada's disappearance than he had to form ISKCON. So we have to see that Prabhupada was working under emergency conditions. With very, very unpromising material. They took the Gentra, but like people practically swept off the streets. People with no experience, no training. The Western culture may have had some good things to offer us, but we rejected it lock, stock, and barrel, really. You couldn't sort out the good from the bad and just dump the whole thing and were ready to start from scratch. Make human life over it again out of bits and pieces we'd read or heard in Penguin paperbacks. So there was no heritage from this side. People were extremely degraded. Prabhupada said, "It is to your credit that you have rejected the materialism of your society, but because you didn't know where to go for an alternative, you've just simply taken shelter of sex and intoxication, and of course rock and roll. Instead of going up, one went down because they didn't know how to go up. But he saw the real search was there, and so Prabhupada provided it. So that's really explains a lot, that only 12 years were there. This is the material Prabhupada was working with. And you notice that the Krishna consciousness movement was expanding very, very rapidly. Somehow or other, the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra was going out, the devotees were preaching, and people were joining very, very quickly. Now, I suppose somebody would make a decision. Well, look, before we get any bigger, we better consolidate what we have. Right? How can we keep on expanding? We don't even... I haven't trained anybody up yet. We don't have any managerial structure. We don't... Let's just slow down things. Let's get three or four temples in really good shape, and then we'll expand. Prabhupada didn't make that decision. He made the decision not to turn anybody away. He made the decision that whoever comes, we'll bring them in. We'll open another temple and another temple and another temple. And so you had, people like me who didn't know anything training other people who knew even less. And that was the circumstances of our movement. We just simply didn't have time to get trained. I became a temple president because here was a temple, and I was, the best of the bad lot, I guess. I mean, it was the only thing you could do. And not that they were bad in other way, but nobody knew how to manage or anything like that. I'm just kidding. So this is what... what Prabhupada dealt with. And of course it also explains that we had a number of problems after Prabhupada disappeared, and it's completely understandable that something like that would happen. And he was the only grown up in the movement. And And so that's quite understandable. But what should be seen here, what I wanted to point out today, was just the potency that Prabhupada had to accomplish so much in such a little amount of time, under such circumstances, and with such material. Because the Krishna consciousness movement is, in fact, going on. Many people thought that after Prabhupada left that we would be finished. I mean, that was, if you took bookmaker's odds in India, we could all be rich, on this. Everyone just thought that we would be finished. And yet, somehow or other, our movement is going on and kind of getting its second wind, and preaching is happening. Devotees are becoming Krishna consciousness. There's more temples right now in Ukraine than there is in the whole United States, and it's expanding in the same way in other parts of the country that it, in other parts of the world that it first expanded in the United States, How did this happen? What was Prabhupada's ability, and where did it come from? Well, he told us, when one Indian man said to him, you've done a miracle, Prabhupada laughed and said, no. He says, I'm not a magician. He said, I haven't done anything so marvelous. Then he paused and he says, only one thing is to my credit. I have always remained the servant. I've never tried to become the master. So over and over again, Prabhupada has stressed that the secret of success in spiritual life is to take the order of one's spiritual master as one's life and soul. And that's what Srila Prabhupada did. That I was told by my spiritual master to preach in English, print books, teach in the West, and because he wrote in one letter, I was first told to do this in 1922, but I couldn't do anything until the fag end of my life, as he put it. And now I'm just trying to do something to satisfy my spiritual master, and he has sent all of you nice American boys and girls to help me, so now I can do something by your help. That was his view of things. Very simple. Just let me satisfy the order of my spiritual master. So this is the parampara system. When there is this is the requirement for that kind of potency to go down, because the statement is that Krishna comes and he teaches Krishna consciousness on this world, comes many times. And then after him, there's parampara, a disciplic succession. Parampara literally means one after the other. Krishna teaches one person, that person teaches the next person, that person teaches the next person. And this way it goes down until we have Prabhupada today, and after Prabhupada his disciples and so on. So how is it that disciplic succession can remain intact? When Prabhupada describes the disciplic succession, he talks about the message being passed down unchanged. And I know when I'm with religious scholars, they're totally skeptical that kind of thing can happen. They see everything, as historical and changing over time and evolving and so on like that. And ordinary people are skeptical too. You play that childish game called telephone, where you ever sit in a circle. We did this in the first grade or something, and one person makes up a sentence, and goes around the circle, one person whispers in the end, and you get a big kick at the end to see how different it's become over the course of transmission. To teach us, you know, that gossip is unreliable, I suppose. And when you hear about, you know, over the centuries, Krishna says one thing and then it's passed to the next person, and it's passed to the next person, and it's passed to the next person. How does it really stay the same? How do we know they make their little changes? I mean, look at all the differences of time, place, and circumstance. How is it possible to keep it the same like that? But then we discover that when we get actually properly trained in Krishna consciousness, that it's not like gossip, one person repeating what another person is doing. But actually the training of a disciple in Krishna consciousness is to make that person capable of hearing without any distortion and repeating accurately without any distortion. Because the things which cause distortion in knowledge and in perception are the dirty things in the heart, the things that arise from the mode of passion and from the mode of ignorance. They distort our ability to hear properly. That's why Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that knowledge depends upon goodness, the mode of goodness. This is the great ignored dictum of all so-called institutions of knowledge, that knowledge depends upon goodness. You want to be a proper student to find out the actual truth, then you have to become established in the mode of goodness, sattvic. Lust, greed, and anger have to be going away from the heart. Otherwise, there is no possibility of understanding anything in its true nature, especially questions like the ultimate meaning of life, the origin of the universe, the controller of everything, all these things. Because people are so much in the modes of passion, the modes of ignorance, they are unable to perceive these kinds of truths. They simply become incapacitated. And then they think, oh, it's some kind of myth. But what Prabhupada and what Prabhupada was able to do, and what anyone in this disciplic succession does, is engage the student in reformatory practices by which they become enabled to actually receive spiritual knowledge. That spiritual knowledge is potent. It's not like learning French or something. It's not like memorized external facts. The knowledge we receive is actually in the heart already. It has to be uncovered, and it's potent. Otherwise, if we don't approach it the right way, it could be right in front of our face and we'll never see it. This was brought to me home a few years ago. I had an occasion to be sitting around a big table with the best scholars of Indology, Hinduism in America. They were gathered together by Sri Chand Hinduja. Hinduja is a very wealthy Indian family. It used to be the bankers, the Shah of Iran. And the Hindujas were embarking on a course. They wanted to establish an international centers for the study of Vedic culture, which has actually been done at Columbia University. They won the contract there. But and Professor Hawley was at this little gathering. But there were Diana Eck from Harvard, Jack Hawley, I mean a whole, they're just the real superstars of this field. And there happened to be a few, I think three ISKCON devotees there. Rasaraj from Bombay, Akunditi from England, and myself. I think those were the three ISKCON devotees who were present. Because he wanted us to kind of help him with this. He didn't go the way we wanted him to go, ultimately, but. Anyway, here I was in a circle with scholars, and I knew these people. I mean, I was trained to be one myself. And I had previous acquaintance with a large number of most of them before anyway, so I knew what their perspective was. Anyway, we were supposed to go around the table and tell about ourselves and what we were doing. And most of them understood, they understood that, I mean, I have a doctorate degree in religious studies like they do. You know, I have the same training to become their colleague, but I didn't become their colleague. I became Prabhupada's disciple instead. And anyway, so everybody went around the table and they finally came to me, you know. And so I just took the opportunity to say that, you know, because they're explaining their various projects and all their projects, because the issue before us was how do we understand the Vedas? This is what Hinduja was interested in. So they're talking about their various projects to understand the Vedas. And so I said that, I start off by saying, you know, a funny thing happened to me on the way to getting a doctorate degree in religious studies. I got mugged by Krishna, and I became a devotee of Krishna. And I said, my approach is different from yours. I said, you're trying to understand the Vedas, and I'm trying to understand the Vedas. Now, the way I go about it, I said, was like this. I said, there's a verse that you know. I said, you've all read this Vaitashvatara Upanishad, which they have, they know it. And I said, and I've read this Vaitashvatara Upanishad, and maybe both of us are familiar with the concluding verse. The concluding verse from the Vaitashvatara Upanishad is Yasya Deve Parabhaktya. Tathai Devi, Tathai Gurau, Tashyaite, Kachita, Hyata, Prakashante, Mahatmanaha. This verse refers to, tells us how to understand Kachita, Hyata, all the discussions that you have just read, because it's the last verse in the Upanishad. So usually when we translate that verse, it just talks about the Vedas, purports of the Vedas. But actually refers to everything you've just read. Katita hyarta. Artha means like purport. The purport, the import, the meaning. How to understand the meaning of all these discussions. To whom is it revealed? Prakashante. It said prakashante means shine forth. You know, to whom will these shine forth? Well, it says to a mahatma. To that great soul. And then it says, what are the qualifications of that Mahatma? It says that to understand the import or the purport of these discussions, it shines forth not just enough to read them, but you have to have parabhakti. In order to understand these things, you have to have bhakti, you have to have devotion. Unto the Lord, Yasya Deve, parabhakti, tatha, Devi, Tathai, Guru. And just as you, as much devotion as you have, bhakti you have to the Lord, you have to have to the spiritual master. He said, when that's there, then everything will be revealed. So I said to these scholars, now, when I read the Vaitashvatara Upanishad, this is how you understand the Vedas. I said, okay, that's what I'm going to do. And then I said, well, you don't do that. That you have another way of trying to understand the Vedas. And I don't understand the way you're trying to understand the Vedas. I said, it really is not very clear to me. And I said, that's why that while you're engaged in the academic study of religion, I'm engaged in the religious study of academics. I said, I'm thinking of starting a journal. I still don't understand to this day, you know, what they think they're doing. Because that tells you how to understand this tradition. Here's a transmission of knowledge that depends upon certain, what shall we call them, existential conditions that have to be fulfilled in the person of the person that receives that knowledge and transmits it. And this is what Prabhupada was doing. He was taking hippies and turning them into happies or whatever you want to call it. He was changing people. So that those people, if they are changed, and properly reformed under disciplinary guidance of the spiritual master can hear and repeat. And if it's done the same potency as there, it's not diminished, you don't lose any signal, there's no noise that comes in to the system. And the potency will act. And not only will people know the truth, understand the truth, but it will also free them from birth and death in the material world. So that's what Prabhupada had. He had that ability to act with incredible potency. And if again we look at, you know, the how much time, 12 years, how fast he was working under such conditions, he did everything very, very quickly. And yet somehow or other, and really without any, we have to say, visible means of support. Because he was really completely said, well, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to follow the order of my spiritual master, come hell or high water. I'm getting old. I'm just going to launch myself out into this enterprise. I don't know what's going to become of it. There's one purport where Prabhupada mentions one characteristic of advanced devotees. He said they do not mind what becomes of the future of their lives. They're just going to follow the order of Krishna. And whatever comes, that's Krishna's business. It's not my business. And that's what Prabhupada did. So, and when we finally give up and just do what Krishna wants and don't mind what becomes of the future of our lives, then Krishna takes care of the future of our lives, actually, and does a much better job with it than we could ever do. And so you can see how what Prabhupada achieved by that method. And so we should also study it and apply it ourselves. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.